Tonight's forum topic is in the form of a question. What is Christian citizenship today? For those of you who are new to the village or who are former villagers who never attended a forum, I should explain a little bit about what a forum is here at Holden. Forum is a conversation where the whole village gathers to inquire together and talk over some question or issue. And the aim of the forum is to get conversations started and gain, as a community, some deeper human understanding of what's involved in the issue, of just maybe how complex the issue might be, and not to reach some kind of bottom line conclusion, or not to hold a debate in which we sort out the winners from the losers, but to engage in a kind of collaborative inquiry through conversation. The way we'll work, I've invited three folks to start us off by making very brief statements that open up the issue so that we're not starting from ground zero. And then the floor will be open. I'm the moderator, which means that I'll just be calling on you and try to keep the conversation focused and moving along. I would ask only that when you raise your hand to make a comment or ask a question or advance our thought in whatever way, that you'd identify yourself just by giving your name, because not everybody in the village knows everyone else yet. So let me introduce the three opening contributors here. To my left is Darlene Johnson, who comes to us from Canada. Darlene works with abused children, with battered women, and she's quite active in the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Canada and has recently attended an international conference in Switzerland this last month on the subject of women and development, right? To my right, we have two of the teaching staff persons. Al Pitcher, to my immediate right, who will begin next week teaching here several sessions on the environment and ecology, and who has been to Holden more times than he can remember. Certainly he's been here every time I've been here. I've been here half a dozen at least. And then Ted Peters, who has been on teaching staff this week and who will be leaving us too soon, and has been teaching on a wide range of subjects, including New Age religion, including the Genome Project, Gen Ethics, and tomorrow, including sin. In other words, the panel really is coming at this subject from every conceivable perspective. And we're grateful to them for getting us started. So without further ado, I think we'll begin in the order of introductions. Darlene, what is Christian citizenship? What is Christian citizenship today? You're welcome to sit there. Okay.
Well, not being a theologian, I didn't know exactly what I would say about the Christian part of it, but I did go to a concordance this afternoon and look up citizenship and citizens, and I finally noticed that the story of Pharisees or other people trying to trip up Jesus came up three times in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, where they asked Jesus if they should give their tribute to Caesar. And his comment, or at least the quote in every one of those books, is, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." So, what is for God and what is for Caesar? In the Canadian context, it's probably a little different than when you look at the issue here in the United States. Canadians are much less demonstratively patriotic. I brought along my flag. It's only here because we celebrated Canada Day in the village on July 1st. I wouldn't have had a flag except that I was going to Switzerland, and a friend said, here, take this, show you're a Canadian. Well, I didn't take it, I gave it to my daughter. That's how unpatriotic we are. But when we were coming to Holden, and I realized we'd be celebrating Canada's 125th birthday, which is kind of a milestone, I asked my daughter if we could bring it, so here it is. But you know, we in Canada didn't have a flag until the 1960s. We flew the flag of England, or one that was based on it anyway. We have no oath of allegiance. Our national anthem is rarely sung. When it is used at public events, it's more frequently to be a soloist singing it, not very much participation. Our national anthem was only officially adopted in the early 1980s, I believe. And at the moment, there's great debate about it because of its gender and racial insensitivity and its militaristic images. So it's being debated at great length right now. We sing in All Our Sons Command. We sing about our native land, and we sing about We Stand on Guard for Thee, and Canadians aren't much to stand on guard for Canada, so we have fought in wars, but to preserve Canada's right, but mostly because of the mother country calling us to arms. It was found out in the Gulf War, when Canadians did go overseas in a more active way than they have done since any other, since the Second World War. A DJ in Eastern Canada found that there was only one recording of our national anthem to be played on radio. And it was very kind of dated in its instrumentation and its melodies. And so he took it upon himself to do this as a project for Canada's birthday. And we now have three new recordings, one very symphonic, one very upbeat, using all of our Canadian artists to sing a line and invoke some patriotism, with changing the words to be a little bit more inclusive. And one is a rap. So we have some interesting things happening. But, you know, only in Canada can these things happen. But even though we don't show our patriotism as much, I think if you spend any time with Canadians, you know that Canadians love their country very much. And because of that, we have the same tensions as you do in the allegiance we give to our country's policies when they might not be exactly what our Christian response should be. I think that sometimes the Christian vision of God's whole new world is different from what Canada's policies are. And I think that we as Christians have the responsibility to challenge those policies which perpetuate injustice, whether that's injustice in our own country or when we have some effect outside of our country and it's an unjust effect. We also have a responsibility to provide support for those who are hurting. In our own Canadian context right now, we have a constitutional debate going on that is tearing our country apart, or maybe the country is falling apart and therefore the debate is going on, one or the other. But we have to deal with the fair balance of powers within the country, within the region, the fair treatment of minorities, our Quebec-speaking people, and our Aboriginal people. These are major questions that we are dealing with right now. Also, the sharing of wealth. Some areas are wealthy, relatively wealthy, and some are extremely poor, and how do we redistribute the wealth equitably? So, major responsibility in the country. Internationally, we've always felt a responsibility to be peacekeeping, to give aid, where it is requested, although our population and our finances are small and it's a drop in a bucket, but there's been sort of an official policy, and yet we know that also Canadians do unjust things out there in the greater world. And as far as pollution and the environmental problems, we're as much to blame as anybody else. We live, we are great energy users and abusers, and and certainly polluters, and we have garbage problems like everybody else. And we as Christians have to look at all of these social concerns, I think, analyze them, make our views known through letters, through statements of the church, through phone calls to our government leaders, to interviews on radio or television, whatever ways we can think of to make our views known. I think it really is our responsibility. And then I think we have a political action to do. Starts with voting for a candidate that will best reflect our views, our moral, our sense of morality. Maybe even running for office if there's nobody out there that can do the job as we think it should be done, or campaigning for someone if that is needed. And finally, I do believe that Christians have to engage in civil disobedience if it's required. So that's my view.
Thank you. Thank you. Al?
Well, I think we exist in a wholly new situation. I think I was brought up to think about ethics as a concern for the good for a person in politics, to think of the good for the polis, for the poll. And I think that the political dominates the individual, because given the social situation, what's good for the individual may not be good for the whole state. And we live in a time where what's good for the whole has to take some precedence. So that I would say we exist in a time where God's world, to be a Christian citizen, is to take God's whole world into account in everything you do every day. To take God's whole world into account. The whole world, that's what a Christian citizenship means. And that is very difficult. But just having got back from Rio, where the Brazilians had a march one day, and they said, Viva Peru, big sign. And keep going, Peru. Bush, go home. I don't state it to state the politics. It's only that they were aware of what was happening in this country as Brazilians. And were interested enough to have a march and have those things in. And most all of the people I met knew enough English to converse. And I didn't know enough any other language except with the nun who was in our convent where we lived, who was German, the only one I could converse with. I couldn't converse with anybody else. And I really felt like a kind of ugly American. I expected them to have the English and to know about our country, and that's the way the world is. We live in a quite different situation, my friend. And it's no longer enough to think about a nation state as the organizing principle, or think about what you're going to do politically. We have to think about the world and what happened at Rio was that the world was present. The world was present in conversation. Now you could ignore the conversations, but there was no way to ignore the judgment that the South was making upon the North in terms of our style of life, in terms of our responsibility for the ozone depletion and the global warming and for all the problems of the world, actually. We are blamed for their disorganized economic situation. We conquered them. We were their governments. We established their elites. Our multinational corporations are working with their elites, who own the land and do not do much for the people in most of the countries. So that there's no way, it seems to me, and the reverberations from Rio will occur for centuries. And it's only the beginning. It's the beginning of a process. 2 months would take 2 years in preparation. It'll be several years after this. And Japan and the European common market will take the lead economically and politically in the world. It doesn't matter how much force we've got. We will not take the lead in the world, even in a destructive fashion. We won't be able to, because it's clear that they are determined to do something constructive, and the rest of the world is going to follow them and not us. So to be a Christian citizen, it seems to me, is to begin to take seriously our need to know what's going on in the world. That means to take a country or two and really learn about it, and to get a language. I'm going to learn Spanish. I've just determined, I don't know whether Spanish is the most important to know or not. Down there, Portuguese is useful. But I we can no longer assume that we're a nice little English-speaking island off here. And I've had this theory for a long time. To be a Christian is to be with, for, and in communion with all people, the natural world, the universe, and God. And at Rio, I've met the world. I've met our world. And it has shaken me. You know, I'm prepared in theory to be shaken. A lot of thoughts. But there, the people were there. And I spent 50 hours with some people from Africa and from Brazil and from Mexico and from the Philippines and from Canada and the Netherlands. And you either listen or you are out of the world. So it's high time, I think, that we as Americans, as United States citizens, began to listen to the rest of the world.
Thank you, Rob. Ted.
I like looking at the Canadian flag. The maple leaf reminds me, I grew up in southeastern Michigan where we had lots of maple trees. Lots of communication with people from Ontario and the Ambassador Bridge that connected the two. And when the Toronto Maple Leafs came to town, everybody knew about it. I'd like to say a couple words of a theological nature. To be a citizen means to be associated with the city. And I think those of us of the Christian faith want to think of ourselves as citizens of the city of God. And the biblical symbol for this is the kingdom of God, or in the language of Holden Village, the reign of God, R-E-I-G-N, not R-A-I-N, in the New Testament. And it's a political image. It's the image of a community or a society made up of diverse people who are living in harmony with one another. And it comes to us as a promise of a whole new world for the future, with certain very poetic but striking visions in Scripture. Jeremiah 31, verses 31 to 34 comes to mind. The new covenant in which the law of God is written on our hearts, or the image of the lion lying down in the land. You see, it's not merely a political, it also includes the natural world in its concept of harmony. Or perhaps my favorite is the New Jerusalem, the city of God in Revelation chapter 21, where there will be no more crying or pain, and God will wipe away the tears from our eyes. Well, that's God's promise. And our citizenship is, in a sense, there, in the city of God. Yet, of course, we find ourselves here, don't we? We find ourselves in the human city, the city of Earth. And what's the relationship between the two? And my approach to that is I think that we begin with God's promise for the future city. Try to construct our visions of what a society of perfect justice, of perfect cooperation, of perfect peace with nature is going to look like, and say, now that's our model. That vision is our model for what life in the human city in this world ought to be, and that's our measure, so to speak, and the reason for constant transformation to try to make the present circumstance look more and more like our vision of God's city. As we move towards the 4th of July, we're going to think specifically, those of us who are Americans, of what our responsibility is, both as a Christian and as an American. And I'm reminded a little bit of Confucius's understanding of our responsibility, because it was always very concrete and particular. And he had sort of a telescope model. Our responsibility as individuals is to become educated persons of high moral contribution. Then you moved out a rung, and we had certain responsibilities towards the family, and then you move out another ring, and it's our responsibility to the community. Everyone has a responsibility to make the community prosper. Beyond that, for him it was the emperor, or we might say the nation, and finally, the whole world. And in some ways, those different rings of citizenship are something that involve us all when it comes to being a Christian who is a citizen of the kingdom of God on the one hand, yet an American on the other. I don't think it's an either-or kind of situation. Unfortunately, in the history of America, many of the founders, as well as many of those who've tried to lead this nation in the centuries that have followed, have always sought to move us in the direction of high ideals that transcend the self-interests of those people who are in power. There's already some leverage there, and it seems to me that our approach to our American identity could be one of, insofar as America serves the whole, to pick up with Alvin Pitcher's remarks a few minutes ago, our concern really is with the whole of God's domain, and our understanding of America's value and role should be in terms of that vision. And when we close in on ourselves and begin to serve only our self-interest to the exclusion of nature or to the exclusion of other peoples, then we're not serving our broader task. That's the tension I think we feel, and I think that's probably enough for a start.
Thank you. Okay, the floor is open. I think that our opening speakers have given us a number of striking images. I heard a bit about Christian citizenship involving some tension between what we're called to do as Christians and what the state sometimes does. And a number of practical suggestions from Darlene about voting and all the way up to civil disobedience. And then Al is saying something like Christian citizenship means global citizenship, care for God's globe, God's earth. And then the concentric circle imagery we got from Ted with the city of God and the promises through a series of striking biblical images kind of being the horizon toward which we strive. So, floor is open.
My name is Eric. Mm-hmm. I'm from Chicago. I'm just wondering about, you know, still the question is, how do you live out your citizenship? When, I recently did a paper on the Cherokee removal, and everyone, all the American citizens involved in Cherokee removal, saw themselves as citizens of a Christian country. But this atrocity was committed where all these people were led away from their homes and this forced removal. And in my paper, I sort of centered in on the two different missionaries. And in my paper, I talked about how everyone involved really was, they were all readers of the Word, serious biblical scholars, and still they were able to, even this one man, he was a Methodist missionary, he went along with the Indians and lived the rest of his life in Oklahoma Territory. But he still felt that the government had every right to do what they did.
So Eric, I guess, is asking the question, tell me if I'm right. given that we want that Christian part of Christian citizenship to have some real content, where do we get the norms for what it means to be a Christian citizen, given that historically people have committed atrocities in the name of what they understood their Christian citizenship to call them to do, right?
Right.
Anybody help on that one? Yes.
I would just add to that, the most recent statistics I'm aware of from Oxfam and related organizations suggest that about 65% of the world's resources are in the hands of Christians. And if that's the case, you know, why does there continue to be hunger? Why does there continue to be injustice? And I would add to that the image that power throughout the ages has always been associated with injustice, and those without power trying to get power so that justice might be served. I guess I'd like to hear from any one of the panelists around how do we, it seems to me that the most we can hope for is to move people from self-interest to enlightened self-interest that takes into account some of these broader pictures that we've been trying to perceive here. And I'm just wondering what insights people have about how we move people from pure self-interest to what some might call enlightened self-interest.
Convert them. I'd say thrice-bornness. I think we need a new conversion. We need a new restoration. We really need a conversion in which the creation is the center of a conversion. We've had the conversion in which we are accepted in spite of the fact that we're really unacceptable, and that really did free us to be something and to get rid of some of this guilt. But now we need a conversion to a real sense of participating in the creation, the whole creation. I don't know how you bring about a conversion. You preach, but hopefully some of the words. See, the Word of God is coming clear to me today, really. You know, take the creation seriously. Listen to it. And if you do, then it speaks to me. Huh? Why? I can't tell. That's a mystery.
If I'm going to just add one thing to that, Al, I would say that the word I keep listening for in the political scene is sacrifice. Calling the American people to sacrifice for the sake of global justice, for the sake of the political economy. And yet, I suspect it will be the last word that I hear during this campaign. And I'm wondering, you know, can we not expect to hear it from that level, but expect to hear it from each other?
Perhaps our geneticists are going to have to look for a greed gene.
A greed gene.
But Al actually had thrown out something in his original statement that might be followed up in terms of a somewhat more practical type of vein. And those of us who are American citizens here can talk to some of our Canadian friends about this as well. One of the things that struck me in a very dramatic fashion, first in California when I lived there, and in the Los Angeles area, and part of very much a multicultural setting. And secondly, now that I'm in Texas and not all that far from the Mexican border, and with a large Hispanic influence, had an opportunity on a couple occasions to talk to people who are not Americans, and they were asking me, well, what do you think about my country? What kind of attention do you pay to my country on a daily sort of basis? And I don't give it a second thought. And after that, I kind of went out my way, and the Canadian crowd could probably talk to us and tell us that there's not a day that goes by when a Canadian isn't thinking about what's going on in the United States of America. There's not a day that doesn't go by. And I know that that is the case in Mexico as well. There is not a single day that goes by that a Mexican national isn't thinking about what's going on in this country. And I could probably testify about all the folks down in Rio as well. And this thing really sort of blew me away to think that there were other people thinking on a daily basis about what's going on in the United States of America. Because I don't do that. I don't think what's going on in Canada every day. It just doesn't happen. I try, and I try to think every day about what's going on in Mexico. But Al, your suggestion was, and I think it would be, here you are wanting to try your hand at Spanish. And you're trying to get into another person's
culture. Well, that shows in Mexico it's a country. You see, I have to preach to myself and do what I say, so Mexico's a country. I've had this idea for a long time that I've been so involved with practical things in our community in terms of the racial tensions that I haven't paid attention to the rest of the world.
I think it's an excellent suggestion. Reading Canadian history is not terribly hard for us to do since we can find some that's written in English.
You'd have a hard time finding it.
But you may have a hard time finding some of that, and the Quebec crowd may not be real happy. But
it's different history if you read it in French.
Yeah.
That's true.
But I know that I don't speak Spanish particularly well, and I'd like to do a better job of it. It always takes me a few days in Mexico before I finally start to feel like I'm on my feet. But you won't know another culture, and you won't know what they're thinking until you start reading in their language and trying to appreciate things in a really much more in-depth kind of fashion.
Yes,
ma'am.
Hi, my name's
Dorothy,
and I really share this vision of global citizenship that you're talking about, Al, but you know, I've lived in a community with you locally, and I don't want that to come at the cost of, in Chicago, at the cost of our working for racial justice in Chicago. In Valparaiso, Indiana, where we live, I think it would do us all well to attend to the rest of the world a great deal more than we do. But I also think that we practice good Christian citizenship by trying to break down the barriers that exist within that community, and that it's costly and it requires sacrifice of a different kind. And when the hungry that we care for are right there, that seems important to me also. Maybe that's something of an endorsement of the concentric circles theory, I don't know. Sometimes I think that neighbors are simply given to us in the course of our lives. I mean, that needy people cross our paths and we immediately respond to them. That's a good thing. And it's something that can be taught, and that our circle of neighbors can grow out from that perspective as well.
Thank you, Dorothy. Yes.
Well, it seems to me, if in particular other countries are very much watching what we're doing, that as citizens of our country, we should be very conscious of what our leaders are doing, and to have our energies be going towards changing the systems and the laws and in directions which we feel benefit us globally, so that I would think to heighten our consciousness of our own responsibility within our own country, so that our country, you know, we can help our country to make decisions that have positive impact and not devastating impact. I mean, I'm just outraged that we have companies that are, you know, owned primarily by U.S. businesses and stockholders that, because of profits, have now moved across the border to Mexico and are creating tremendous pollution, toxic waste put into open dump fields, dumped into water ponds, etc., and they're flowing. I mean, we know this in our country, it's against the law here to do it. And yet, to cross the border, do it there because they can make higher profits. I mean, it's sinful.
Very ambiguous, though. They're also providing money for Mexican workers.
Yes.
I mean,
$3 a day?
I don't know how you get rid of that ambiguity. I had to fly to Rio, and I said to my wife, you can't drive to Washington. You can't drive the whole village. You can't use that much gas.
And yet, you know, isn't there, I mean, I'm not against jobs, you know, being available, you know, being created for people in Mexico, but how dare we, with what we know, pollute the land?
Pollution.
I just
I agree with you, but on the other, I mean, it's very ambiguous.
Yeah.
How are you going to help Mexico develop economically?
Let's do it responsibly.
Without providing some capital.
Using the knowledge that we have.
I wish there were an easy answer.
Yeah, it's very complex.
The session that I was at in Geneva was dealing with world development issues, and certainly we agreed that development must be helping the people to reach their full potential, but not at the cost of nature. And it must serve justice rather than injustice.
And the Brazilian will tell you, well, you want us to save our forests? I mean, what do you want them for? Why do you want them? I mean, you want to develop the genetic stuff we've got down here? Do you want to use them as carbon sinks for all the carbon dioxide you're producing? Why don't you change? Why don't you change? And why don't you give us, if we can't use our forests and sell our lumber and use it for growing stuff, not worth much, of course, about 4 years for a crop, but still, if we can't do that, then you've got to compensate us for it. That's the discussion that was going on in Rio. I wasn't in with the big wigs, but that's what it was reported, and those are the issues. And I asked Thor once, we had a meeting with the senators, our U.S. citizens there, and I said, well, why don't we let the third world decide what to do with this money that's, Japan is going to give $7.7 billion in the next 5 years to this global development. Why don't you let the southern nations, instead of having the World Bank, said, yeah, but the nations who give it won't let it out. I mean, they want to control it. And they control it, of course, for the benefit of their own countries. I mean, we give money to third world countries on the basis that they will use it to buy our products. And it's such a complex, interrelated thing. In 1986, we dumped rice on the market. The price of white rice fell half. It was $8 a hundredweight. It went down to four. 4 million times, farmers lost their shirts, and we subsidized our 19,000 rice growers. Now, when you talk about Christian citizenship, it involves such a complex of interrelated policies on the part of the nation. And I certainly believe that you've got to work at home. But the question is, how do you work at home? I mean, you can work at home by not using the gasoline, so that Brazil can use its forests, and we aren't so dependent on them. You can work at home by not buying so much, and then we have a minor recession, but you're not using all the resources. We use, 20%? Use 80% of the resources of the world. And all kinds of resources. I mean, we really need a revolution in the way the way our whole Western society thinks about the production of material things and the possession of material things. But I don't know how you begin to bring that off. You can't bring that off the Poland Village.
Okay, this gentleman back here had his hand up.
I'm from the Los Angeles area. A brief comment. I have kind of a pet peeve. I think that education is like the major problem that relates to everything that we're discussing here. And from the youngest to the oldest, I think racial issues would tend to dissolve a lot more if people were just aware and educated in what's going on. They aren't capable of having the kind of consciousness they need to be involved in these issues. And there's no excuse. There's just no excuse at all for people not being educated, both in this country and in the world. There's so many resources and technologies available. To me, we're in a pathetic state in this country when we spend so much time watching TV and piddling away time. That's just my personal one issue that I think is really important.
Hey, first you, and then we'll come back here. Yeah.
Great segue to what I was going to say.
Your name is?
Jill. Alcone from Eugene, Oregon. I had the great privilege of having a Writing 123 teacher this last term, who is a Christian man who is very involved with environmental issues. And for an example of how you can affect education. As an assignment for his class, and we all had to write a research paper, he assigned us to read the book The End of Nature by Bill McKibben, which is a very readable book and covers a lot of issues. It makes the point that what we have done to nature is probably irreversible, and we now need to be an active part of doing something about that. For my paper, I chose the field of education because I too agree that traditional education is not addressing these issues fast enough to alert and create awareness in the general public. And so I looked at alternative forms of education. And through my research, I dealt with various ones, but I also wanted to include my personal experience. And of course, I thought of my many times at Holden Village and the things I've learned here. And as I outlined what I've learned through my times at Holden, it suddenly became clear, when it really hadn't been clear before, that Holden is a lifestyle workshop. It's an experiential lifestyle workshop. And we not only get to hear about these issues and how we can relate to them as Christians, but we get to live them out. We get to think about the fact that when we put our chewing gum into a tissue, someone on the garbology team is going to have to change that of the tissue. We see children eating lentil loaf. I mean, we see lifestyle changes, and they start becoming a reality because we're living them while we're here. Plus, we're listening to other people. We're interrelating. We're hearing ideas and synthesizing those ideas. And whether we know it or not, we take away a different perspective. And my conclusion was that if the church could only know about Holden Village and embrace it as a model, the church at large, if the many denominations throughout the world could create other retreats just like Holden Village, that we would have the most effective way to reach Christians and in a very gentle way bring people to an awareness that could change the world.
I'd like to know what happened to the solar dryers.
Solar dryers.
Eric, yes.
Well, about education and how to live in the world. I really don't think that our churches do a very good job of equipping us how to do moral discourse, and or even as a place to have moral discourse. Maybe everyone here could ask themselves about how their own congregation reacted to the war we had with Iraq. I know how it was the congregation I was at. And we didn't talk about it. It was never preached anything or even put forward as something to think about how the gospel or, you know, the word of God would affect that war. And, all this stuff, is extremely divisive to our basic congregation. There's a lot of people will say that one of the most divisive issues their congregation ever got into was where to put the flag.
Mm-hmm.
We chuckle about, congregations have split in two, mm-hmm, over the flag was going to be next to the altar, next to the pulpit, or maybe over to the side with the veterans.
Canadians don't
have
flags in their churches.
We don't anymore.
So we're not even formed in our formation as Christians to talk about this stuff without getting violent about it. So I think that we need education, not of course not just in our congregations, but in our public schools and everything else. I didn't really pick it up in either my church life or in high school, how to do, a system of ethics, how to simply do moral discourse or to make moral decisions for myself. I sort of picked it up piecemeal. And it seems like, all these great minds, we ought to be able to come up with a way of teaching simple morality, how to make a decision.
Yes.
John, I've been listening to a lot of discussions here this last week and even tonight, and the thought that strikes me so much is Christ told us what we had to do. We had to love God and love our neighbor as ourselves. And the only thing that we're arguing now is who's our neighbor. Is it the person next door? Is it the person around the world? Is it the person in our church? And, you know, it's a simple solution. It's just that we're not willing to deal with it. Because if I have to treat my neighbor as myself, then I have to make sacrifices, which is what was said earlier. And that's where the difficulty comes. I mean, we come here, and you sacrifice eating red meat, but at the same time, you've got a snack bar with candy bars and ice, willing to give up some of the world, but not all of the world. And, you know, that's the decision that we're struggling with all the time, whether it be in our churches or in our own personal life, is how much am I willing to give up to accomplish whatever it is, and will I give it up unless the other person is also willing to give it up at the same time? And I think that's the struggle that we're all facing, is that we aren't ready to do it at a personal level because we don't think it's going to have enough impact. So we depersonalize it and go at the global issue, which is far away, and we can struggle with it, but we don't have to address it on our own personal level, where it hurts the most.
Well, maybe the part of the answer to that is that we're called to be faithful, not to be effective necessarily. And so, at first, if we give these things up, if we can't show that we've reduced world hunger one iota by, you know, eating on the food chain in a different spot, if that's part of what we discern as a community and work out in, I like your image, Joe, of a workshop, work out in a workshop of experience, which helps us to get to the educational issue of how we begin to change our consciousness, then maybe if we simply get into new habits and are formed into new virtues as Christians, we can leave in the hands of God whether or not this ultimately becomes effective. That's a theme that was introduced at a Bible study recently that I'm simply building on. Just to kind of configure some of the things that have come out and then ask others to jump in again, we've had a couple of notions here that I'd like to hear people explore further, and one of them is that part of what Christian citizenship means today, in terms of the concentric circles that Ted laid out, is that maybe Christians need to be focused, in terms of their consciousness, on that outer circle and working inward. That is, to pick up or to paraphrase what I think Al was saying, something like thinking globally and acting locally, which is Jacques Ellul's phrase. Others have said, well, look, the workshops where you learn what justice means by practicing it are really families, neighborhoods, communities like Holden, and one works from these inner circles outward rather than the outer circles inward. So I just want to like hear people play with those images and notions, whether Christianity and a change of consciousness along Christian line means focusing on the outer circle and working in, or focusing on the inner circle and working out. So let's hear from you first, and then we'll go back.
Mariana, I feel about the only way one can impact your own government and impact how our government works with the world is by letter writing to your Congress and your senators and impact them. If our churches would work an issue within the congregations or within the whole, like the Lutheran Church or the Episcopal Church or whatever, and everybody could combine and work in that issue and get their congregations to write letters to their government, and perhaps some kind of change can be effected. Just doing it alone doesn't make too much of an impact, but I understand that when lots of letters come in, it does make a difference as far as the way they work.
So organizing through churches,
and that can be
after
done.
The discernment
Bread for
goes
the world
on.
Works that way, and a lot of us accept it. You sit down during coffee hour at church or whatever, or between services, and have stamps and letters and addresses and everything ready, and everybody sits down and writes their letters. You can send off 100 letters in one day.
Okay, thank you. Yes,
again, my name is Bill, and I direct a nonprofit organization in the Seattle area trying to promote a model of ethical leadership
to help communities consider how do we create a moral climate in our inner cities. One of the things we've been talking about lately to kind of help in this conversion process, oftentimes one of the sectors we're dealing with, trying to bring into this discussion, is members of the corporate sector. And oftentimes discussions get to a level of, you know, there's so much information to manage out there around, you know, global consciousness sort of thing, that how do we stay informed? One of the things we're promoting is that each person become friends with someone who lives below the poverty level, that you become friends with a homeless person, that you become friends with a person of color, and if possible, you become friends with a person who lives in a third world nation, believing that friendships are going to make me consider these people my neighbor, and will really, that friendship, that heartfelt connection, is going to make more an impact on my own personal choices than all of the great information in the world.
Mm. So it's a face-to-face relationship in which you build the whole ethical formation and discernment that you're trying to do.
Which is a part of the gift of holding again, because we meet people with divergent points of view, but we break bread together, and we have ice cream together. You know, I can't separate myself from the people who I might differ with. They're a part of my community while I'm here, and somehow I learn something more about myself and the world through them.
Thank you. Other comments? I thought I saw some other hands here.
Well, I think that's right. I say, but policy's got to come. Policy plus connection. We had 25 people in Central America from our church, but we had done a policy statement on where we were in relationship to our government's relation to Central America and to all this stuff. And once they went there, then we had two families sanctuary with our churches, and all kinds of people had to learn Spanish and stuff to carry this out. We still got one family related to us. It's connection plus policy. If you don't have the policy, you really are at a very low level of, and that policy, and I wanted to get back to John's comment, because John said what it is what, who's our neighbor, but I think we don't know what to do with alcoholics and with the dope addicts. And I live in an all-black community. I live in a community with 50% poverty. I worked trying to do all kinds of things in this community. And you got a 12-year-old selling dope. And the woman who took over the Development Corporation, where I was executive director, got on dope. And, it's not simply a matter of love, of having a good will toward a person. I mean, there are complex things. You've got a person who's been abused. My daughter's been abused as a child. And you've got that history to take care of. And I didn't even know about it. And I've been reading books on it and stuff. And she just wrote me a letter just now and said, I can't get rid of this stuff. You know, it isn't a simple kind of affection. I wish it were. And the international issues and the national issues and the issues of the city of Chicago are very complex in terms of policy. So I say love, yeah. I mean, you got to care. Got to care. And connection helps you care. That's right. Connection helps you care. But then you got to be sophisticated and educated and work at it, I think, very hard to know what to do. And I wish there were an easy answer.
I think John wants to respond.
Well, I agree with you, and I would love to solve these issues at a policy level. And I think it would be wonderful if we could take the most educated people and, say, address these issues. But the reality is that we haven't done that in the thousands of years that we've been here. And we have to go back to what I think is a simpler model. We have to deal one person at a time. And if I live my life as the best model of a Christian that I can, and I affect the people that I work with directly and that I live with directly, that is the fundamental solution to solving the problem. I would love to do it at a global basis, but I think you have to do it one person at a time.
Well, I've got an eschatological program too, to get 5,000 acres and 2,500 people and have a kind of self-reliant, you know, 80% self-reliant lifestyle and not have cars and have your own recreation. Have the potter who was here create our pottery for us. And he, you know, he would, you know, all kinds of stuff to simplify life. That, but that's eschatological. And that came out, you see, at Rio. My group was on alternative economic models. And there was a guy from the Philippines who was in Marcus's cabinet at one point and president of three banks, and he's decided that's not going to do it. None of that stuff. So now he's taking island by island and trying to develop a kind of self-sufficient, what he calls, island economy, not an enterprise economy, but an island economy. And but the guy from Brazil, the labor leader from Brazil, says, you know, what are you going to do? These corporations are here. You've got all this economic life. You've got to intervene in some way. And I've got a program to intervene, which I'll talk about someday.
I think we have time for one more word here. Does somebody have a word they'd like to leave us with on this complex subject? We're approaching 10 o'clock.
Well,
yes, Ted.
I do, but it's going back to a much earlier stage in the discussion. With regard to how we formulate the issue so that we can, I like the phrase, thinking globally and acting locally, so that we can do that. Those of some of you have already heard me. There, in my judgment, there are three major social drivers: economics, politics, and culture. One of the things that's misled us in the mouth of President Bush is that we're confronting an issue of either jobs or protecting the environment. And as long as we pose the question that way, we're in deep trouble. We need somehow or other to reformulate the question. Business interests want the question posed that way because all of us have a self-interest in having a job. So if we have to choose between them, then the business interests will be able to drive the political interests. Thinking about what Darlene had said earlier about the WCC discussion on development, somehow or other, the question needs to be reposed so that jobs contribute to the preservation of the environment in some fashion or another, that the economic incentives need to be restructured in such a fashion. And that's where church leadership and ethical discourse play a role. And then finally, letter writing to our congresspeople. We kind of look at this thing in a different way. And then just an anecdote on some remarks made earlier about the United States sneezing and the rest of the world having to put up their handkerchiefs to defend it, defend themselves. I spent a good deal of time in Sri Lanka last fall, and Sri Lanka has had, relatively speaking, a successful socialist economy since the mid-1950s. And even though it's not at a high standard of living, universal education, universal health care, a number of the objectives that a person who really wants to see a society function well have been achieved. But with the deregulation and the the rekindling of the capitalist flame in America during the Reagan years, it's been, and the impact that that has on the worldwide economy has led many companies to a position where they could either, by adjusting their buying and selling with Sri Lanka, have forced them, their economy into a position of weakness so that they have to privatize. They're now in the process of privatizing their healthcare, their school system, their tea plantations. And foreign investors are now coming in to buy that stuff. And It was exacerbated, of course, with the fall of the Soviet Empire and that kind of thing. Now, it is just simply true that what goes on in this country, not necessarily politically, what goes on economically, it just reverberates throughout the world. And I think in the long run, we just have to think holistically, and not by that I mean globally, when we're trying to make long-range plans of these.
Thank you, and thank all of you. I think that as I predicted or promised, we haven't answered the question clearly, but we've marked out some directions for future conversation as we point toward what we're celebrating here in the village on Saturday, which is Interdependence Day. And so I hope you'll keep the conversation alive, and thank you all for starting it off so well. Have a good evening.